most people play school, I would play store, make cards and print them on our home printers. Like high school, I babysat a lot. All these ideas for how to turn the Toms campus program into this like street style blog. A lot of introspection, a lot of anxiety in that period, realizing how bad I was at bringing ideas to life. A bit of a hustle in college. I've bought and resold and bought back textbooks for people and gave them cash on the spot, making sure everyone working for me reported accurately. Entrepreneur over the years. Entrepreneur is someone who takes on an entrepreneurial role within another company or within a corporation. It's a really valuable skill set to be learning while you're on someone else's wrist. They're like, wear a black suit. Like, I'm someone who takes one sign, I'm like, nope, done. Limiting freedom of expression in an industry that's about freedom of expression. When you're here in the city called Insider, it's concierge service. Jack of all trades, master of none. So you had to be good at it, but you also had to be fast at it. Rethinking, like, where did I want to go? Why did I come to New York? It wasn't like a traditional role, even though I found it really valuable and interesting. You learn pretty quickly that having someone know someone is way faster and better. And she was working for MakerBot, the 3D printing company in Brooklyn. So our job was really to, how do we raise awareness about this, partner with the right companies, both on a marketing partnership scale that have a wide reach. Like, we signed the deals to make it possible and like figure out what the right margins are, but then we also would train them. So I'd be flying out to their headquarters. Did downsize so much and they had to lay off a lot of people. Realizing when you work for someone else, you will always have limited control, always. And that's by design.
So you get laid off. What do you do next?
And you say, I'm never working in 3D printing again. I had told them going in that I wanted to have my own company next and that was gonna be in a totally different space. And I think moving away from New York to an interesting, cool place like Hong Kong, but where I didn't really know a lot of people, it gave me the time and space, like mentally, to remove myself from like my current life.
You already had an idea to start a fashion business at this point.
Correct. So before I even moved to Hong Kong, I went and worked in Taipei, Taiwan with Hacker Paradise, which was a remote digital nomad-ish community. Had a community around me and people, and we would have sort of sessions where you'd talk about what we were working on or wanted to work on and then get feedback from the community. And I had like a long list. And he's like, just pick one. But the most important thing was I didn't know where anything in my closet came from. The only stuff I wanted to hang on to was the stuff that I knew had like a story behind it, or I had had some hand in making it or remaking it. Going in 2016, I just abstained from all purchases of new items. I could buy whatever I wanted that was secondhand. Figure out how to get clothes made, starting with a blazer, because I personally love blazers and I had a design already in mind because I had a cool blazer for my mom. I decided, what if I could just like rebuild this from scratch, but like all the little things I didn't like about it, maybe I could make it perfect for me. And I called it, my project idea was the perfect blazer. What the perfect blazer was like, recreate it for yourself, fine, but challenge yourself to try and bring it to other people. It took me about a week to get a prototype made. I teared up when I picked up this jacket because it was like this idea and then it was a thing. So I went to Vietnam one weekend, just like talking, and I would say, that was really the only skill I had because I didn't have any design experience or classes, and I really despised the idea of going back to school. And that through word of mouth, I was able to go to one. Even if it didn't work out, I learned something, and then I found another. But finally, I put a jacket on that literally felt like butter when I slid it on, and I thought this was the feeling that I had in mind. This is like what I would want women to feel when they tried it on for the first time. At least the jacket prototype was there that I was like, this is it. This is my blazer number one is the name of the product. Explained to them the vision behind the brand, which was to create a closed loop system for clothing. So starting with my brand. Me, most of my customers, bless them, want to hold on to the jacket. And they say, like, I want to pass this to my granddaughter. Why would I ever sell it back to you? At scale, it works. Confusing market for customers out there. And to me, the business model is where I thought sustainability makes sense. I have this thing going on called the Replay Trading Company. You can go and either purchase cool, like reused product, or learn how to remake things yourself. So also featuring projects and places where you can go. Like for example, my pants. Hawk printed these
just
yesterday.
Stay there.
So this is a pair of pants I found a couple years ago that I wasn't wearing. I had a stain on them. I started a sustainable fashion circle meetup series in New York. So we've done monthly events. Ancient Indian method of carving out blocks, literally hand carved. I just saw the whole process. Let me stamp your clothes. Seeking feedback or ideas directly from customers about what would help them solve problems.
You think you've grown as an entrepreneur? In what ways?
I've learned to be a lot more realistic. I'll dream big and have big ideas, but what is the most realistic path forward? Realization that you as an individual hold a lot of power within yourself. A balanced and whole, I need a lot less than I thought or society told me I needed.
Hello, startup hunters. Thank you guys so much for listening. This podcast would be nothing without you. And also, this podcast is a startup, so I need all the help that I can get. Would you please leave me a good review in the App Store? This would be huge. That's it. On to the episode.
Welcome to Startup Hunter, also streaming on YouTube. I am here with Allison Vicenzi of the Vicenzi Fashion Brand, and they are doing fine women's wear with a sustainable business model. So I know you've taken a look at the show, Allison. What we do here is we go all the way back to the past. So I would like to know, where were you born and what did your parents do?
I was born in St. Louis, Missouri. Still have family there, still dream of living there. And my parents, my dad is a lawyer and my mom was a nurse up until she had three kids, and then she ended up having five kids, so she was a homemaker for our lives.
So did your dad have his own practice?
He does now. He's developed it over time, but he's worked in for different corporate clients as well in startups.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think any of that rubbed off on you as a little kid?
Interesting. No, I never really, I don't know where my entrepreneurship ideas came from. I think my dad is very entrepreneurial, but he was working corporate for my entire childhood. But I do know that he kept notebooks with all his cool ideas, whether they're business or creative or scripts. And I found those over the years. And I think that creative strain has definitely influenced me. But as far as entrepreneurship, that was just something I started doing mostly by scamming my little sisters as a kid. Like most people play school, I would play store.
You would play store.
And I would charge them to buy my old things.
I love it.
I feel so bad about this now. Yes, that was my first shop.
So was your store inside of your bedroom?
Oh yeah, but I would have a little table obviously, and then I would have a composition notebook where I would keep the log of prices and, you know, the discounts I gave.
I love it.
Should have been five finger discount for the family, but no, like this bag, I spent $15 on this. I'm gonna give it to you for $8. It's worn. But of course, they're sweet, they're supportive, and they no questions asked.
Now, were you the oldest sister, the middle sister?
I'm the oldest sister, but I have an older brother. So it's boy, three girls, boy.
So you're number two, you're not the middle child?
Not the middle child, no.
And a middle child in a five-child family is a whole other ballgame than a middle child in a three-child family.
Are you a middle child?
I am a middle child, the first child, the last child, the only child. I love your first hustle. You're setting up a store in your bedroom. What's the next hustle that you can remember?
Oh, gosh.
Maybe a little older.
I mean, around the same age. The other hustle, I have to give shout out to my cousin Aaron. I don't remember the name of the programs, but when computers first launched, like photo editing and kind of, not Microsoft Paint, but there was some sort of software, I don't remember, that you can make cards.
Uh-huh.
So we'd make cards and print them on our home printers, like super low quality paper, you know. And those are our greeting cards, and we'd try and flip them to people.
Yeah.
That was a major fail. Did not work. I don't know if we made any money. Not even from family. That was poor quality.
So
my next hustle, though, in high school, I babysat a lot.
Well, that's sort of like being an entrepreneur.
Sort of. I mean, my parents had an amazing rule that you couldn't get your license unless you had a job.
Uh-huh.
In high school. So I started working at Ben & Jerry's literally the day before. I interviewed the day before I went to take my license test, so I kind of pushed to the limit. It was a hustle because it was, we hustled within the system. Things, you know, just the ways to get paid more fairly when you're making $7 an hour. That's what kids did.
Sure.
That's sort of a hustle. But no, honestly, there were a lot of years where I did not hustle at all. In college, I had so many ideas and I didn't do most of them. I just thought about them a lot or wrote about them.
So what did you study in college?
I went in as a math major, but then I switched to finance second semester. So I was in the business school.
And where did you go to school?
I went to Notre Dame in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
Mendoza College of Business.
So tell me, what do you think is the best idea in college that you wrote, that you had that you never did? If you can remember.
So I signed up to be the Toms. You remember Toms? I mean, of course, you remember, everyone knows Toms now, like the one-for-one shoe company.
Sure.
I was a big fan of that idea, and because that was one of the first times I saw like social enterprise in a way that was not a non-for-profit, and I liked that idea. And so I signed up to be the ambassador. I don't know if I like this ankle. I signed up to be the Toms ambassador for our school. I don't know if I had any competition, so I was accepted. They sent me a package with like 1,000 stickers. And coincidentally, the founder, Blake Mykoski, was speaking at our business school like around the same time. I didn't really have anything to do with it. I got put on the email chains to help out, but that wasn't my doing. But I had all these ideas for how to turn the Toms campus program into this like street style blog.
Yeah.
Using Facebook, because Facebook's so popular with schools, obviously, like school networks. So I started a Facebook page, and I had so many ideas of like, if I saw Toms on someone around campus, I would take a cool photo of them and publish it, publish the story, and like raise awareness about Toms, but also show the styles along with it. And I just like never did that. I started the page and I wrote all the goals on the page and I invite all my friends and I had the camera and I just like did not execute ever. And then I graduated early, stayed on campus and didn't feel like I should do it as a grad, even though I was still there in South Bend. So I just
So you went to graduate school?
Let that one die. No. I just had to wait it out until like I was on campus because I had an apartment, but I was graduated, so I wasn't taking any classes. But like full graduation was in May with my friends and everything. So a couple of us that graduated early, we just stuck around.
Okay.
Did a lot of crafts, a lot of reading, a lot of introspection, a lot of anxiety in that period. And that's sort of where I think I was realizing how bad I was at bringing ideas to life.
Yeah. And how long did this post-graduation period last? Did you move somewhere to after that?
So that was, I was there till May. It went pretty quickly. And a lot of friends, you know, by senior year, a lot of people are only taking a few classes. So there were like, it went fast. We had fun, but I was so ready to leave campus. But then I graduated with no job because I didn't have a good plan.
So you didn't have a good plan. You didn't want to work in finance.
Didn't want to work in finance. I did want to live in New York City. So I grew up in Connecticut.
St. Louis, when was St.
Yeah,
Louis?
Yeah, so I left St. Louis when I was 4.
And then
in denial until college, where I thought we'd always move back. But no, I like Connecticut. We grew up there. That's where my dad's side of the family's from and where he grew up. So it's basically a suburb of New York City, about an hour away on the train.
Absolutely, right to Grand Central.
Right to Grand Central. So, yeah, so I would say I had an internship for the summer at the company my dad worked for in Connecticut.
And what kind of company was that?
That was a textbook publishing company. It's not there anymore. But yeah, they made textbooks for college students. And I did have a hustle in college. I bought and resold and bought back textbooks for people and gave them cash on the spot.
There you go.
Because you spend so much money on textbooks, and to resell it yourself is a pain.
The
company I work for, I think it was called Better World Books, I hope they're still around, their idea was like, we'll scan the ISBN on the spot, we know how much it's worth on the secondary market, and we'll give people cash right away. So that was a cool hustle, and I helped a lot of people make money, and that sort of fit into my whole reuse thing, which has always been important to me. And I remember I was like to the cent, I got the finances right. I was really proud of that. It was like less than a couple $1,000 total, but I remember being like very particular about not losing any money and making sure everyone working for me reported accurately.
I love it.
So that was a little hustle. That was like literally the only job I had, paying job, within that entire 4-month period. So I definitely milked that on the resume a lot of like, oh, here's what I did in my off semester.
But it's more than a job. You're an entrepreneur.
Sure, but I like to me, I was working for someone else, so I didn't really think of it as entrepreneurship skills at the time. Now, I've learned about this term, intrapreneur, over the years. Intrapreneur is someone who takes on an entrepreneurial role, within another company or within a corporation. So kind of like a franchisor, that is that example. Like I was the entrepreneur within Better World Books, but even within a big company, if you're leading a new division or a project and you're sort of the leader, the visionary behind it, and you get agency to see it out and hire the team or whatever it is, that's an entrepreneurial role.
I love
it. And a lot of like successful entrepreneurs have done that at big companies because you get the finance and backing of the big company
just
and the marketing.
Like, just like Sharon.
Yeah, exactly. But you develop those entrepreneurial skills. Yeah, watch Sharon's episode about Brewasis. She's a huge inspiration to me. And I think I wish I'd known earlier about that term. I didn't even learn that term until I'd already quit all my corporate jobs, but wish I'd learned about it so that I could recognize that that's a really valuable skill set to be learning while you're on someone else's risk.
Yes.
Capacity. And yeah, anyways, entrepreneur, that was, I guess, a little hustle. And then I went back to Connecticut, where I'm from, worked for a couple months in an internship, and like,
what was the next move?
The next move was to get to New York. So I was applying to all these fashion finance jobs. And I thought, I was like, I have this finance degree. I care about fashion. I'll just try and work like corporate or merchandising or management, like kind of a business program within fashion companies. And I was applying to like the big Macy's and Bloomingdale's and learning all about their corporate. I didn't honestly shop there that much. So I was like learning about these stores. Was like, in theory it made sense, like combine these skills, combine these interests, but in reality I was like totally faking it. Like, I didn't actually know what it would be like to work there, would I want to work there. I just thought of them as like big fashion names. So I started going through the interview process, and I remember specifically for one of them, they said the next round was an in-person interview, and like a bunch of people were going to show up on the same day for it, because it was a program for new grads where you'd basically be put in rotation for 2 years. A lot of industries do this, and they were like, wear a black suit. And that to me, like, I'm someone who takes one sign, I'm like, nope, done. Like, if I was working in fashion and not being told what to wear, it like canceled it for me. So
it canceled. So that was,
it's like cancel. That's like, that is limiting freedom of expression in an industry that's about freedom of expression.
Uh-huh.
It was a huge red flag to me, and so I like did not pursue that further, but I at the same time was interviewing for one of my friends, another fellow grad, Henry Shine, who graduated early with me. So we spent a lot of time scheming the last semester of college. His cousin, Lindsay Shine, has an amazing company here in the city called Insider. It's concierge service. So they basically help private and corporate clients get literally anything legal done. And yeah, I mean, I could talk for hours about what that type of job is, but it was like a total shift from what I was expecting to do or thought I wanted to do. But it was in New York. They were super cool. And I went and talked to them. We were like, it was just a room of women. Everyone was working hard, but like it was interesting stuff and solving problems. And I just,
so was this concierge service 100% female run? Like not a single man at the service?
Correct. At the time, the staff was all female. Henry and some other interns over the years had been male, but I think it just worked. The energy
of
all the women worked really well. Sort of the skill sets needed and the customer service required and the craftiness.
And
just the
know
interest in the industries too. Like you had to be interested in all these different like culture, food, finance. That's where our clients mostly work. Like you had to know a little about a lot. A jack of all trades, master of none was a phrase used a lot.
I think
they were masters more than they gave themselves credit.
I want to know about the craftiness. When I think of concierge service, you know, I think like you press a magic button and then this magic genie gets dispatched and your wishes come true.
Well, that's the craftiness, is never letting people know how it's done, right? So they put forth a request. It could be as simple as we want to go to dinner at 11 Madison Park tonight, or as complicated as, you know, my daughter needs a dog to assist her because she's got different disability issues and we want to like take on a pet to help with that. Like, that's, I mean, there's a wide range of things and a wide range of timelines, and our job was just to do it on time and as efficiently, because we were basically paid per time, right? So we had to bank all our hours and tell them how much time a certain task would take. So you had to be good at it, but you also had to be fast at it. So it was like, it's a whole matrix. I mean, they had this whole underground network. I mean, you can't do it unless you have a network of people in almost every industry.
I know, it's fascinating.
Yeah, so that's only, it's human capital, right? It's like she spent years hustling and truly developing relationships with all, I don't want to say the right people because there's not the wrong people, but like the people in the industries that would mutually benefit each other going forward, because she's sending amazing clients to them to be regulars and to be supporters.
So how long did you do the concierge thing?
I did the concierge thing for a little over a year and a half through Hurricane Sandy here in New York,
or right.
Superstorm Sandy, if anyone remembers. And our office was relocated during that time period because it got severely damaged over on the East Riverside. So we were working out of a hotel in Midtown, all the girls in a hotel room for a few weeks. And that was, I think, the time I started rethinking, like, where did I want to go? Why did I come to New York? What do I want to be working on? So much value out of that job, but I just felt like I didn't know, I couldn't see anymore where I would go with this. And I got a little nervous, because I was always interested in startups and in consumer brands and products and just these things that I love. I felt like I was kind of going in the wrong direction, and got nervous that I would never be able to explain the value of this job to the next people I wanted to hire me, because it wasn't like a traditional role, even though I found it really valuable and interesting and super hands-on, which you don't usually get that early.
So you were applying to other jobs?
I applied to one job during that period. It was Warby Parker, and I'm anxiously waiting to hear back from them for that role. But I really like that company because I've worn glasses since I was 7, and they made glasses cool again. They made it possible for you to have more than one pair of glasses. I grew up, you know, you can only switch them out every 2 years, which is a huge, huge strain on your style, really, as a kid. So now with Warby Parker, they're making it more affordable, more accessible. So I was really a fan of that brand, and I wanted to work for them, but yeah, that didn't work out. And then that's when I started looking to, the personal network, which I realized after countless interviews sent into the online abyss. Like, I thought if I wrote a good enough cover letter or application, they would surely find me. But you learn pretty quickly that having someone know someone is way faster
of
and
course.
Better. And it's, there's no shame in going that route. Obviously, don't like abuse it. But if you have like honest, true intent that you want to meet someone or do something or work somewhere, and there's a person within your greater network that can help you with that, there's no shame in asking. So I met a woman, Jenny Lawton, through my dad, who used to work with her at a different startup, and she was working for MakerBot, the 3D printing company in Brooklyn.
Of course.
Of course, we all know it.
I just was at a speech with Bree Prentice, the founder.
Where was the speech?
It was in some industrial software company, and he was just talking about his latest stuff, and I got to hang out with him for a bit. It was cool.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Small world. That's where I was. And at the time, yeah, I was like, I think I was like 127.
127?
Number employee.
Oh, okay.
I don't know where you thought I was going with that. I don't know why I phrased it that way. But that's pretty low. Like, they had just moved into their first big headquarters in downtown Brooklyn.
Sure, I know the building.
The Tech Triangle. It's still there, Metro Tech, I think.
With the creaky wooden stairs.
No, that was the older one.
They visited
there, probably on Dean Street. But they were growing like crazy, and it sort of fit all these buckets of, I like to make things, MakerBot helps people make things. It was creative. I didn't go into Meter to work there. I went to talk about VC. I thought I should be working for VCs because they got to work with a lot of brands.
Yeah.
But after a meeting then I met with another person who ended up being my boss for several years, Tom James, on the business development team, biz dev as it's called. And I remember interviewing or getting a request if I wanted to interview for a biz dev role there. Didn't know what biz dev was, had to Google, what does biz dev mean?
Uh-huh.
No one really can define it.
Well,
so.
biz dev is running a store in your bedroom for your brothers and sisters.
Now you know. I didn't know. I mean, business development in a good way can mean a lot of different things to different companies. In this company's particular case, they were growing like crazy, and they had a lot of inbound requests for partnerships, corporate partnerships.
So just to give people who don't know MakerBot, it's a 3D printer. It's pretty much the first 3D printer. They raised a lot of money, very successful commercially. It's an expensive 3D printer, but it's the first, and it works absolutely great. They have a great brand. So here you are building and helping to build a serious brand. What kind of corporate partnerships would a 3D printer company need?
Oh, it was everything. I mean, you start to realize that when things are very popular, like 3D printing, consumer 3D printing. So industrial 3D printing had been around for decades, machines costing as much as $100,000. And what MakerBot did was brought it to the desktop consumer level, less than $2,000. And that was the true revolutionary product that put MakerBot and put 3D printing really on the map for people that weren't just in a strict like engineering. Stop. I just saw this yesterday. Clothing by the pound. We have to come back here.
Cool.
Sorry.
Clothing by the pound.
It's all related. It'll come out later. So it was sort of opening the minds of people that have a design focus or are already designing in 3D for their job or their life. Like, they would know about 3D printing, but this sort of started to put it in front of just your average Joe and Jane. So our job was really to, how do we raise awareness about this, partner with the right companies, both on a marketing partnership scale that have a wide reach, or a retail footprint, so we could put 3D printers in the stores, and people could go see them at their local mall. And then we also covered a bit of software-related partnerships, so how do we make our software pair nicely with other important design software, like all the 3D design softwares
AutoCAD.
Out there. AutoCAD, exactly. So Autodesk was the first partnership I came on to work for. And then sales partnerships, because obviously you can only sustain a cool business idea if people are buying it. And we had our own internal sales teams, but also needed to partner with enterprise sales. So working with Dell, for example, because they were selling, it was really funny, people that sold like 2D printers, as we'd say, they wanted to have 3D printers because it was like a cool new offering on their boring, sheet list.
It's okay.
of things to sell. So that they had like customers that I learned so much about sales and enterprise sales. So they had customers who had sort of gone dry or lost interest. This was like, hey, have you heard about this 3D printing thing? We've got 3D printers. And so we were able to help them do that because we gave them, we signed the deals to make it possible and like figure out what the right margins are. But then we also would train them. So I'd be flying out to their headquarters to train the employees on what 3D printing was, how it could apply to different workflows. And
question, how long did you altogether work at MakerBot?
I think 2.5 years. Before I was laid off?
Regardless of that, did you grow in position? Did you start managing people?
Okay, so when I said I started working on the biz dev team, I was the first hire on the biz dev team. So it was me and Tom. And then we ended up hiring a team. I think at one point it was 7 or 8 people total. So we hired up that team, and then I shifted roles a couple times, so I grew within that position, I guess. Took on different style roles, would manage, instead of supporting a project as a project manager, I would manage a project, start to finish. Like Martha Stewart, for example, that was, I think, the first one I did completely, start to finish, had to define it, meet all the right people, invite them, set up the deal, basically.
Now, what did MakerBot do for Martha Stewart?
And this is a good example of the variety of partnerships that they would take on, that we would take on, is Martha Stewart, we had a couple different ways where we let them show, like, help them use 3D printing in their design process. So they already had smart CAD designers on staff that were so excited to have a MakerBot at their desktop.
So they started prototyping.
Right. So for we would go by and they'd be creating the next round of pots or pans or handle, like redesigning a handle. Because Martha Stewart's got amazing partnerships across the board in retail, like Home Depot and Kmart, Macy's, everything. So that was one way. And then the other way, which was more, I would say, like more advanced or more sort of up and coming focus for MakerBot at the time, was to start to test the market for purchasing digital products. So with the 3D printing world, it grew so fast because MakerBot, before they started MakerBot 3D printers, Bree and his friends at the time, they all started Thingiverse, which was the online universe of things. And it was all the free open source 3D design files.
So that you can print yourself.
Exactly. So if you didn't know how to print or you didn't know where to start, you can download and print, or you can download Riff on it and print, all for free. And it would come not only with the file, but like with advice or tips or pictures of how to do it and how to make it successful. So
you said you got laid off.
Yeah.
Do you think, were they downsizing? Did they get acquired?
They got acquired earlier on in my career there, and it, you know, in different phases, we would integrate with the parent company, Stratasys. So, start working together and like going to different conferences together, or, like working on business plans. Some teams did not, though. Some teams were like left just MakerBot. Like Thingiverse, for example, was a MakerBot run company that Stratasys hadn't really integrated with, but I was on the sales and marketing side, so we worked a lot together. And then I took on a role, which was the education division, and that really integrated with Stratasys because they had a new head of education who I really liked, and we worked well together, so we would partner a lot. But it was kind of uncertain where things were going to be within a few months because so much was changing, and they had new CEOs, changeover and reorganizations and restructuring, typical for any startup. Now I know that more, but it's sort of like you're living through it and you sort of see things coming, but you don't really know. And everything, like they could throw a wrench in something in one day and everything starts over. So
I always think that the more entrepreneurial types, the ones, like let's say a typical employee works at like a level anywhere between, just to put a number, 7, 8, 9. But anybody who works at a 10 or 11 or a 12, right? Anybody who's like really a type A personality, and maybe they view that person as a risk. That's just my
an entrepreneurial person could be a risk. Oh, interesting.
Well, I mean, in a corporate culture,
I could have seen either way, right?
Because in a corporate culture that doesn't have,
we were sort of the resistors, right? We're like, we were the old MakerBot, so we were saying like, we know what the customer wants. We know how to explain this product. Like, this is what you need to do. But at the same time, we're 24, 25, 26. No, I wasn't even, I don't know if I was 26 yet. Like 24, 5 years old.
Yeah.
And these people had been around a lot longer. Who's right? I don't know, right? Because it never really shook out because they did downsize so much and they had to lay off a lot of people just to make the business more sustainable, which is great for the long run of the brand and of the business. When you're living through it, it's sort of like, but if only you did this, or if you put this person here, like you think that you know, but you have no idea because we don't know all the pieces. Like, we're just on one team, and even if we talk to our other friends on other teams, everyone has limited knowledge, and it's a real true testament to realizing when you work for someone else, you will always have limited control, always, and that's by design.
So you get laid off.
So you get laid off.
What do you do next?
And you say, I'm never working in 3D printing again. That was cool, but I'm over it.
Uh-huh.
But then I went and worked for another 3D printing company because they were cool and I wasn't over it. And I wanted to like take this stuff because I had built up this whole education plan and ideas. And that was a market I knew really nothing about except as a student. And I got to learn the whole market, the sales, the marketing, teacher support, everything that went along with education and education technology, specifically in the maker movement, which I find incredible for schools. I wish it were more prevalent. When I was in school, it actually is. I went back to my high school and they've got 3D printers and sewing machines and everything. It was not there when I was there. So I'm very personally passionate about that move in education. And I wanted to try and continue the work to an extent and help another company. 3Doodler is the first 3D printing pen. And that's really consumer friendly. You don't have to have any design software. It's really just drawing in the air or on top of things, or there's a lot of different ways to use it, but you don't have to use a computer at all. And the price points are more accessible for schools and for people, those average Joes and Janes that were really trying to get to use 3D printers and see their potential.
A 3D printing pen sounds like a lot of fun. How long did you last at that company?
So I worked there for 9 months, I think, total.
So that's pretty quick. Now, were you already like jumping at the gun to do your own thing at that point?
Yeah, I mean, I had told them going in that I wanted to have my own company next, and that was going to be in a totally different space. And
do you think they were okay with you telling them that?
I think they're okay with it. They're entrepreneurs, and I definitely worried about that a lot. Like, was I being true and honest? But I feel like I tried as much as possible to explain like where my head was at. But what was great was working for them. I was working in Hong Kong to get started because
wow.
They didn't have a New York office yet. They're based in Hong Kong, which I didn't know until our first Skype call. We had all these emails, and I'm wondering why they're scheduling in a Hong Kong time. So they're based there, and honestly, that was what, like, I knew next I wanted to, like, revisit all my ideas and try and start a company. Now having done it, work for other people that started a company and working directly with people like Bree, just inspired by this chasing of an idea and seeing what happens. So I like knew I wanted to do that, and I think moving away from New York to an interesting, cool place like Hong Kong, but where I didn't really know a lot of people, it gave me the time and space, like mentally, to remove myself from like my current life and think differently, think more broadly about what would come next, while still working for that job full time.
I bet the noodles were great.
I'm not a noodle person. I'm gonna say that on the record. But the dim sum's great. The noodles are great. If you're ever gonna have them, that's a place. But no, the food, the culture, everything was really cool. There were a lot of hiking. That's where I really first started hiking. Not that I'm like a master hiker now, but I definitely like it.
So you're in Hong Kong for 9 months.
Mm-mm. So I was there for only 4 months on and off. I came back to New York and back to the US for some education conferences and different work and life things. And then came back to New York and was working for them for a few months here, and then had to have the talk about,
I
just don't think I can do, they were so gracious in giving me like time and taking a day off here or there to go to a fabric conference, for example, that was in New York.
So you were already had an idea to start a fashion business at this point?
Correct. So before I even moved to Hong Kong, I had already narrowed it down to that idea. And I went there first just as a consultant for a couple weeks, and then a couple weeks after that, I went and worked in Taipei, Taiwan, with Hacker Paradise, which was a remote digital nomad-ish community where people were working remotely on any sort of projects, tech, a lot of tech-related, but entrepreneurship, design. So it was during those 2 weeks that I had a community around me and people, and we would have different sort of sessions where you'd talk about what we were working on or wanted to work on, and then get feedback from the community. And the main feedback, literally day one, from my friend Casey was like, you need to pick one of these things. Like, yeah, I had all these ideas, and they were all in the same space. So to me,
they were all in fashion?
All in just like, merging sustainability and fashion and reuse, sort of like everything I was interested in that world. But I had all these different campaigns in mind and all these different things I could do, and I had like a long list. And he's like, just pick one.
Not Casey Neistat.
Picked one. No, no. Oh my God. If I just like, yeah, Casey, first name basis. No, I never met him. Casey Rosengren, cooler than Casey Neistat, on the record. No, I'm just kidding. I've never met him.
Done.
But yeah, so I was like, okay, of all these, it all fits together in the long run. So in the short term, what's most important? And for me, the biggest black hole was how are our clothes made? Like, I wear clothes all the time, love them, love style, whatever. Like, I can go on about that. But the most important thing was I didn't know where anything in my closet came from. And I had just gone through, when I was moving, well, I was subleasing for those, like, for like 6 months. I had to put my stuff in storage or get rid of it, and it like was this aching process where you have to decide like what to get rid of, where does it go? I mean, that could spin off a whole new business, but the main premise was like, where did this stuff come from in the first place? And the only stuff I wanted to hang on to was the stuff that I knew had like a story behind it, or I had had some hand in making it or remaking it. And I realized that and I thought, okay, first off, I'm not gonna recreate this problem that I have, which is having too much stuff, so I'm not gonna buy anything new. And that was like, so I kind of narrowed down to two project ideas. One was called No New Stuff. So going into 2016, I just abstained from all purchases of new items. I could buy whatever I wanted that was secondhand, borrow anything, and I can make anything myself. But those are the rules.
These are the self-imposed rules.
My self-imposed rules. And that was one, and the other was like figure out how to get clothes made, starting with a blazer, because I personally love blazers, and I had a design already in mind because I had a cool blazer for my mom that fit really well, and unlike any other blazer I could buy, and I wanted to get it fixed, and it was really, really expensive to get tailored garments fixed because of the lining and the complexity, so I thought...
So wait, you were just going to local tailors here in the city?
I started by going to local tailors in Hong Kong.
Uh-huh.
So I brought the jacket, and I'm like, I just want this again. Like,
and they were giving, they were charging you what you felt were very expensive prices.
Oh, so sorry. I went in the city before I left, like, getting quotes, essentially. Like, how much would it cost to fix the lining, which was, like, wearing out, or... Yeah, exactly. And they would say, oh, we'd have to open it up, and it's going to be about $150. And I was, like, record scratch. Just like, what?
Oh, wait, let's just, like...
Yeah, let's get some AC.
Do you even want to go in here and just without the camera?
Sure.
Talking about, you know, sort of how tailors were maybe ripping you off.
Okay, so now I've done a lot more research with tailoring, and it's not a ripoff because it does take a lot of time to redo those things. And I would question my own former self by saying, if I really wanted like a patch inside, which no one even sees, inside a jacket repaired, could I have just done something that was sort of hacked together and not gone the full, like, of course the tailor, you're hiring them to do a service and they want to do the best service possible. So they want to make it look clean and crisp, like you never knew anything was wrong. But as a consumer, did I need that level? Probably not. But I didn't know how to even communicate that option to other people or figure out how to do it myself. Now I know a lot more. But at the time, that was like a jarring price point, because to spend $150 on something that, even though it's a great heirloom piece, I didn't see how the economics worked, and I didn't think I had enough money to do it. And I decided, what if I could just like rebuild this from scratch? But like all the little things I didn't like about it, maybe I could make it perfect for me. And I called it my project idea was the perfect blazer, really meaning perfect for me. But also because I was trying to, like, during this layoff period, I had a few weeks where I didn't have a job and didn't know for sure if I would be getting the job with Redoodler, and just sort of had like some time, introspection time. And I started thinking about like all these ideas I've had even since college, and like, why wasn't I doing any of them? So the idea with the perfect blazer was like, recreate it with for yourself, fine, but challenge yourself to try and bring it to other people. Cause that's where I noticed all my projects failed, because I would make things that I thought were cool, whatever, blogs, like dumb things that now I see the relevance, but at the time, like, I sort of questioned, like, I didn't question when I was making them, but I questioned, like, why did I do this? What was the purpose? And where did I think this was going to go? Like, and with this project, I wanted to be very clear from the beginning that the point was to give it to other people, or give the option to other people to purchase it as well. So it wasn't just going to be another project that, like, sat in my own house, or I don't have a house, what am I talking about? That sat inside me, and it was something that I would try and push myself to share with other people for the first time. So it was called the Perfect Blazer Project.
And how long did it take you?
It's a tough question, because it took me, like, it's crazy when you, like, decide to narrow focus. It took me about a week to get a prototype made.
That sounds like
Which was, like,
really...
literally one meeting. Yeah, it's really not
fantastic.
That hard.
No, did you
once
make
you
it
have
in...
a clear idea, the hardest part is deciding what to do and where to start. But once you decide, it's pretty easy. I went to one tailor.
In Hong Kong.
So they weren't a factory. Like, if I had gone straight to a factory, I probably would have been scared. beyond.
But now you're not
project.
Scared of factories.
Now I'm not. Now I understand. But that took a couple rounds of trial and error of my communication skills too. But I went to the tailor and I just explained what I wanted and what I want to change. I picked out new fabrics, new buttons, everything. That jacket was magic. I'd say entrepreneurship has made me a much more emotional person, like in touch. But the time, like for me, crying was not frequent, and I like teared up when I picked up this jacket because it was like this idea and then it was a thing.
These are tears of joy.
Tears of like shock and awe and joy. So happy. And now I look at that jacket, I'm like, this is garbage. I can't believe I thought this was cool. It fits horribly because I've since shown it around to the industry and they would point out all the flaws with it, but I didn't see the flaws because I made it.
Didn't you make it for your mom? So it fit her?
No. Opposite. I took her jacket that fit me, but the ones I created, because I customized them for me to be the sample size, they no longer fit her. They're too big for her. So she's super petite. And that's where like the other jacket failed for me. So I needed to like size it up in certain areas and make it a better shape for anyways.
Shape for you?
For me, and then for anyone who was my size.
Okay.
Which became, because you have to pick as a designer, you pick your sample size. And that's sort of like the mid-range. And then it gets scaled up in size from there. So you're not recreating the pattern necessarily for every size, but you're just scaling it up by a quarter inch, half inch, in these certain different points.
So you show it around to people in the fashion industry.
So then when I got back to New York, so I got a couple more samples made in Asia. I went to Vietnam and visited a friend, Jen Rowling, who's working on a women's business wear startup as well, where she would take people's sizes, like measurements. They would send their measurements to her, and she would get the items made for their size in Vietnam and then send it back to clients. So it was like right in line. Our friend Bill put us in touch, and she was super cool and friendly and just said, come out and visit. And I was like, we'll take you up on that. So I went to Vietnam one weekend. Well, because when you're in Southeast Asia, I learned that it's pretty cheap and easier to fly country to country, like a 2-hour flight. And you have to pay like $25 for a visa and things like that. So it was an adventure. It was super fun. And there in Hoi An, where she was living, it was really easy to get stuff made.
Even easier than Hong Kong.
Different than Hong Kong. Hong Kong, I went to like a business tailor, like somewhere where like I literally found it because of an ad on my hotel room TV when I was there the first time, like catering towards businessmen to get their suits made for them. But in Hoi An, it was more set up like a factory. So that was the first time I really saw a factory floor as part of the process. And it was a lot less expensive. Like you can get a whole wardrobe. Well, that's hard to define what that is, but you can get several suits made for under $1,000. Like a jacket was $45. To make a sample, which just to bring it back to New York pricing, it would be like $450 to get a sample, including like the time and the fabric and notions and everything.
So you go to Vietnam, do you work on your perfect blazer there with all the feedback?
I hadn't gotten any feedback yet. I was just still in my own little world of like, I thought the first one was good, but where else can I experiment with it? And I changed up, like some of the linings were patterned, and I did know from the 3D printing world that helps to have prototypes to show people. So I knew eventually I'd be getting back to New York. And if I were to make this company, I would want to be able to show different varieties to people and get their feedback, like the customer feedback. But At this time, I didn't know any feedback. I didn't have any good or bad feedback. I didn't really even communicate to them in Vietnam what I was doing. I just said I wanted this jacket made, and here I picked out, it's super easy. You can get anything made there, by the way. Anyone can go and be a designer there. And you could copy things, like take a Pinterest photo and they'll make it for you, no questions asked, it's really affordable.
So,
but when I came back to New York, I was like, okay, now, that didn't feel real. It felt cool and interesting, and I learned a lot, but I want to make this real. And to me, real meant make it in a factory and get like a proper, I never had a proper pattern because I was just like talking, and I would say, that was really the only skill I had because I didn't have any design experience or classes, and I really despised the idea of going back to school and paying for that. And I thought, just take that time and money and just apply it towards like trying to do it in the real world. That felt more natural to me. And so I'd go around explaining to people what I wanted made, but I felt like in order to make say 100 of them, I needed to have a standardized pattern and process. I couldn't just keep making samples. Now I kind of question that line of thought. I think if someone wanted to start a clothing brand, I would tell you to maybe just make 12 samples. That was my, so I said I wanted to make it a more of a real thing. I thought it was like very much my little experiment. And I wanted to be a real company and a real brand, a real designer. So I wanted to go back to New York and like put, basically check out the proper boxes of bringing a product to market. So what I was saying was, as my advice to people starting out, maybe I would say you don't need to do all this. Like, you could just go to market with a couple samples, take amazing photos of them, and get pre-orders. But for me, I couldn't do that. I needed, because I was a product person and a product-based brand to start, I needed to like see the product. I didn't feel comfortable selling things, say pre-order, Kickstarter, whatever, selling things to people that I didn't actually know how to create, because yeah. I'd heard all the horror stories of like not being able to fully produce on spec or on budget on time. So I was like, I just need to make as much as possible with my own budget, like self-funded, just on the money I was saving from all those years working at startups. And so I came back to New York and I like had to try a bunch of different sample makers and communicate what I wanted, because I didn't have a designer on staff and I didn't have a budget to pay for one. Maybe that would have been a good use of money, but anyways, I didn't know. So I was just like taking it step by step, and I would have one sample that went totally in the wrong direction. It looked more like a men's jacket, and I realized I just was having communication issues with that pattern maker, so I needed to find someone else. And luckily, like through all of this, and now that I was back in New York and I was, you know, working different, not working, but like had different hobbies, side interests, meeting different people, especially in fashion. They were super helpful in telling me where to go next. So if I would be stuck on something, I would like, out of the sky, answer to prayers. Like, people would come and be like, oh yeah, I know this person. You should go talk to them. I'll bring you there. Like, I'll introduce you to this. Because a lot of these factories, they're trying, a lot of companies and startups are trying to digitize the garment district and like make it a...
I know of such a startup.
Yeah, and so it's a good initiative to try and take the information, basically Yellow Pages, and put it online so you can find factories. But at the end of the day, a word of mouth recommendation is the fastest and easiest, because they can introduce you, you can build trust immediately with that. And there are like, I don't even know the number, but there are hundreds of factory options in New York. So how do you even narrow it down to start? I think it's overwhelming to have a directory of all of them. So I'm very fortunate that through word of mouth, I was able to go to one. Even if it didn't work out, I learned something, and then I found another. And I just kept going through the process until I felt like this was good enough.
Now, okay, so here's what I want to know. What item did you feel was good enough?
Okay, so I remember specifically, so this was, now we're talking January 2017. So I quit 3 Doodler by September 2016. And that was like, ever since then, I've been on my own. My solo entrepreneurship phase began. And so it was a couple months later, I picked up a sample. I was like, okay, this one feels right. Because it wasn't just the fit that I had to fix through a couple of different rounds, but I had like also narrowed down the fabric choices, and each sample along the way was different and like could be better here but worse here. But finally I put a jacket on that literally felt like butter when I slid it on, and I thought this was the feeling that I had in mind. This is like what I would want women to feel when they tried it on for the first time. And that's when I knew it was ready. But of course it wasn't that easy. Like, the factory that made that, then I didn't end up, I was thought, okay, this is it, like I'm gonna go to production with them, it's gonna be done. But I ended up having some snags along the way and had to get a new factory, and a lot happened. But at least the jacket prototype was there that I was like, this is it. This is my blazer number one is the name of the product. And I thought, this, at least now I have this, and I have the pattern for it, and I have the materials decided. So even if all this got destroyed, because there were several months of traveling and everything where like I would have everything on my in my luggage or something. And like, God forbid something happened, and of course I'm fighting with the airlines, like, no, I can't check this bag, even if there's no overhead room, like, I need it, because that was all my work and all my investment. And
you didn't want to.
If I didn't have it, I'd have to start from scratch. But now that I had several, and so I got, like, way too many of these samples made, because I wanted to be able to pass them around and get feedback, but also I was, like, it was my insurance policy to say, like, I have enough of these now that if, God forbid, a fire, I lost everything but one, like, I wouldn't have to start from scratch. And that was a really good feeling, even though it took several more months for me to actually like go straight through to production.
So let's talk about how that blazer was received and like sort of the business aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think every single point has been a test for me. I was testing something, whether it was the fit of the jacket, that was my first pop-up. I partnered with a great friend's brand called Grant Stone, and they do men's footwear, like super high quality, direct to consumer, men's shoes and boots. And so we have very similar design ethos and quality standards, and it was really helpful to be able to talk to them, even just through my production process, about like what are the steps and what are the POs that need to be placed and how long will things take. And so they invited me to do a pop-up with them here in New York, and that one for me was all about fit, because that was the first time I had jackets in the full range of sizes and had women come that could try them on. So it wasn't as much about sales, it was more like, does this actually work? Because I've only seen it on me and on people that are my size. And so that was a good feedback point. And then after that, I've just had, I don't even know how to, that's where it gets complicated, I think, as an entrepreneur. Like, I don't know how to decide when I was working or when I was just like chatting or meeting friends. Like, I would always have kind of jackets on me and people would ask to try them on. And sometimes I'm like, is this a full work thing? Is this a friend? Is this a client? It's like very blurry, honestly, for a few years. And I was just taking in so much feedback, which is good and bad, because you can only take so much where it just overwhelms. And so I did different pop-up styles. I did like street fairs. I did, booths with friends. I did a rack within my co-working space. Like, I tried a lot of different things, and testing a lot on the pricing discussion was always sticky for me, and the business model, like really trying to, within a very small amount of attention that you get from people, like trying to explain to them the vision behind the brand, which was to create a closed loop system for clothing. So starting with my brand, but then ideally any brand is going to adopt this model in the future, where you buy things that are high quality, meant to last, you keep them as long as you want, but then if for any reason at all you don't want it anymore, it doesn't fit, don't want it in your closet, you've grown out, whatever, any reason, the brand, my brand, Vicenzi, would buy it back, give you credit towards new objects, items, as a thank you and as an incentive to do this, and then we would then restore it and resell it to the next customer.
So talk about that.
Give
me an example where a customer has bought something from you and then actually taken advantage of that policy.
Yeah, well, this is like what I learn as an entrepreneur. So you create your minimum viable product, right? And your minimum viable prototype of your business model. And for me, that was having one SKU, like one product. It's multiple SKUs, but one product and then this offering of this closed loop. But the issue that I ran into, or realized I was going to run into pretty quickly after launching, is that people don't want to sell it back to me. Like, because it's a product that's not trendy, it's one that they intend to keep, and because they invested in it to begin with, I'm not at a scale yet where, I think if you're a big scale fashion brand, you have all types of customers, and some customers will be ones that have disposable income and they buy and flip things a lot, others will be ones that buy and hold on. But for me, most of my customers, bless them, want to hold on to the jacket, and they say, like, I want to pass this to my granddaughter, why would I ever sell it back to you?
Yeah.
So that's where I hit snags of like, yeah, that's a good point. That's actually a better, that is maybe nicer than me trying to buy it back from you. But at scale, it works. So now I'm enter this phase, like, I realized that quickly. So over the last few years, it's like, then you start having conversations with bigger brands, brands that I admire and have shopped from in the past, and about them, like, they have an existing customer base, an existing product seated in the market, and that's what I lack, right? Like, I don't have enough product in the market that's ready to be returned, but the big brands do. So I started, you know, talking to them about what would a circular economy model buyback program look like for them. And you mentioned Eileen Fisher earlier, and she's definitely one of the first to offer this, but to me, just to be frank, like, you're getting $5 back for every item that you sell back to her, and her items are like $500 average. So that, as a consumer, and I'm trying to approach everything I do with a consumer mindset, because I am a consumer and the consumers set the business. Like, without consumers, we have no business. We shouldn't be in business. So I'm like, why would, that doesn't make sense to me. That's almost like worse than offering me $0. So I wanted the business plans for myself or any other brands that are interested in the circular economy to really price it in a way that makes sense, that you're capturing a higher percentage of that resale value that starts to compete with me trying to resell it myself. Because that's the other option, is I can resell things to The RealReal, to Poshmark, to eBay, to whatever, in a street fair. Like, there are resale options, but the idea with the a circular business, closed loop business model is to make it so the brand does all the work for you in finding the next buyer, and they guarantee you a purchase price, which no one's really doing at a way that makes, I think, financial sense.
And you've figured it out.
I feel like I have the feedback, and now I understand the messaging. I understand where the consumer. I think the go-to-market would be different for every brand depending on their customer and what they sell and everything like that. But the basics of this idea are totally viable. And in the industry, we talk about it, like, why isn't this already happening? This makes total financial sense. But then talking to brands, you realize where they're hung up. They don't have someone in-house that specializes in this. It's a distraction from their other sales or business goals. You only have so much time to talk. It's the same reason that brands that are inherently sustainable in their product model and design decisions, they don't necessarily always market themselves as sustainable because they've chosen to market themselves as maybe like an adventure brand, and sustainability is like a part of that to them, just at their core, but that's not where they choose to focus their marketing efforts. And then you have the flip side where brands that are inherently not sustainable make sustainability promises just to capitalize on the trends, and that's called greenwashing. So it's a very confusing market for customers out there, and to me, the business model is where I thought sustainability makes sense for everyone involved, incentivizes the right behaviors. It's not just like a feel-good, nice thing, but it actually financially makes sense, and you can model it out for any brand, but they're afraid to start because no one's really doing it. So they're like,
but you're doing it.
But I'm doing it, but I need people to know about it and talk about it and demand it for other brands so that it makes sense. Because to me, it only makes sense when you have more options available to you.
So it only makes sense where it has more options to you.
Right. So for me, where my brand can't execute on this promise right now is that I haven't even launched the second product because I've taken the brand in different directions. So if you were to sell it back to me, say I did have a customer that wanted to sell it back, and I offered them credit, all she could buy was the exact same thing in a different color or size, which isn't bad because we do sometimes just need to change sizes as women. That happens a lot, and I think that should be part of future business models as well. That's a side note. But I think it makes better sense, it's cooler, and it's more interesting if you could have other products. So if you're a brand that has a lot of products, even if they're not changing every season, but you have like my dream for my brand was to create just this library of styles that are not gonna change that much, kind of perfect each one by one. They all fit together as part of a system. They're not that complex, they're simple, they're designed to be easily repaired and restored, and the brand would help service that or find local partners that would serve. Like, I wanted to have this whole contained system, but I'm not there yet, so the circular business model becomes less interesting to even market because I need to focus more on just like marketing it as at the industry level, or focus on other aspects of the product to make it that people even want to buy it to begin with. So it's a lot in flow, but I would love to talk to any brand owner or someone who knows brand owners or designers about how circularity could work for them at both a pilot level and at scale, because we've put together models for this, and I've just given out free consulting help basically to any brand because I believe in it so much and I want to see it happen. And if other people do it, I won't have to do it, and I can do other things, because that's sort of the beauty of, I think, working in sustainability or working like on different projects. If you have a lot of ideas and you see someone else doing it or doing it better, you can sort of let go and you can support that. So maybe that'll happen.
So what's your plan for this fiscal year? Like, what are your goals for the year?
Great question. My goals are a couple. So one is to take the Blazer number one, which is already an existing product, and get it into different markets. So for example, you can now go try it on. Because one of the things it's a direct consumer company at its core, but it's also this product at least is very much based on fit and feel of the fabric. So I needed options where people could do that more consistently, and pop-up markets really don't work for that. So now, as of this week, you can go try it on in Williamsburg at the Canvas.
Where's
cool
that?
Space on Bedford Ave.
And North 8th and 9th.
Kind of, yeah, right around there. Exactly.
Yeah, I know. You've seen it's a flea market with, but it's like a
it's new products that all have sustainable development goals.
Ah.
Yeah, each one in different ways, and the tags explain that, and they're really focused on only bringing in products that meet those standards, which is cool. So you're surrounded by products with different origin stories and meanings, and you get to kind of read the tags and figure out what's cool and different about each product. So the blazers are now there, which is great. That's a great home for that.
So you're selling blazers.
Aspect is selling blazers just because I want to get more in the market, seed the market, so that you can really understand the closed loop. It won't work at a super small scale, but as more people get it or hear about it, like what happens? That's just sort of like the curiosity, is to see what happens if I can get more blazers into the market, but cap it. I'm capping it. It's an exclusive run. I'm not doing another production run of those in the foreseeable future. So I have some stock, and once those go, that's it for now for blazer number one. So the other thing, that's one goal aspect. And the other thing is introducing, so there's basically a side project I have going on that came together from merging of all these ideas that are on the side that I needed to just like put a name around it or put an idea together. So I have this thing going on called the Replay Trading Company, Replay Trading Co. And that is becoming a space where you can go and either purchase cool, like reused products, so things that are dead stock and restored, or cool vintage that people have found, like basically anything that's not new, or learn how to remake things yourself. So also featuring projects and places where you can go, like for example, my pants.
Well, let's show.
I just block printed these
just
yesterday.
Stay there.
So this is a pair of pants I found a couple years ago that I wasn't wearing. I had a stain on them. And I saved them to one day do something better about it. And I found a place where I could do this. So some new friends of mine that I've met in the past couple years and more recently are, on the side, my friend Namu and I started a Sustainable Fashion Circle meetup series in New York. So we've done monthly events where basically people interested about these concepts can all meet, whether they have a business in the space, so they want to start something, or they're just curious, or they work in fashion, they just love style, they love the earth, any reason you can join. And through that, I've met a lot of amazing people working on different aspects of solving these problems and introducing cool new solutions. So block printing is something I literally started last week, but you take like ancient Indian method of carving out blocks, literally hand carved. I just saw the whole process last night. Carve the blocks to a certain design style. This one was just like straight up and down lines, but you can get logos, you can get like scenery, you can get animals, whatever. They're beautiful. Dip them in paint and like permanently stamp your clothes.
Yeah, and we were talking about that. If you have a stain on your clothes,
yes,
you can get one of Allison's great designs. can somebody send in a pair of stained clothing to you and you'll block print them, or that's not what you do?
That's not what I do yet, but I would say I'm willing to test that. If you know anyone watching this has an item, they should reach out. So, because I do have the ideas for solutions, and I realize that that information is not widely known yet. So I'd love to help people solve it, but at the same time, I would love for them to come learn how to block print themselves. I think in order for a lot of these ideas to scale, and going back to what I was saying, of just like, I would like to meet consumers wherever they're at and introduce solutions to them too. And it's sort of more interesting to me that they could learn to block print their own, and I could, or the network of people that I know now could help guide them to do that. But I don't love the idea of like shipping things to a centralized location to then be fixed and then ship back. It's a lot of shipping and transportation, but maybe things could be dropped off and like local solutions could pop up. So I definitely have ideas for the future of where there could be like local centers for remaking, like a co-op of different talented people and businesses even come together and offer these things in a very fun, easy, accessible way. But for now, those don't exist at scale, so I can help guide you or help remake things with you. But yeah, the idea of covering up a stain or a hole or something, and you don't even notice it anymore when you have something else going on, and it's a totally unique to you garment. And I think between block printing, embroidery is another cool method, just like refashioning things, like sewing two things into one, like cutting out parts that are not damaged and remaking them. I'm excited about those types of movements because they really do create value in an industry where right now we have a lot of waste and a lot of like stuff. I think taking some of that stuff and instead of just trying to flip it, which is already happening and like kind of reached a capacity of interest.
With Rent the Runway and...
Yeah, it's like there's so much secondhand stuff out there, but why aren't, I just have to always ask like, why aren't most people doing it? Why are they not? Why is this not interesting to them? And maybe the prices aren't exactly right to get used things, honestly, like unless you love the thrill of the hunt, which some people do and others don't. And so, but if you take something and now it's like a unique, only you have this style, or it was your old thing or your heirloom garment that's now been remade, I think that creates a value and creates an emotional connection that's a lot more interesting to people, and they're willing to pay for that more than they would just like buy something off ThredUp that's like just because they're saving a couple bucks on like a mall brand item.
Okay, so in wrapping it up,
yeah,
my feeling and my, I've listened, and it feels to me like, you know, you have a very strong thrust in Vicenzi.co, which is a brand, and they have an Instagram page and a website, and you're actively working on this brand, which is making items, but also giving customers the option to return them. And then on the other end of the things, you have some side projects going on where you're really trying to find something that works as far as sustainability goes.
Yeah, I would say it's taken several years to figure out how this all might fit together. In my head, I knew it would. And now I'm finally feeling more confident that Vicenzi as a brand is there to make high quality, like not basics necessarily, but high quality garments that will last you a lifetime or the next lifetime. If they're properly cared for, which is all part of the business model, is to provide care instructions. So there's like this whole angle of just making stuff built to last that will not change, that you can also return, like keeping it closed loop, keeping it simple. So that can expand as needed or as time or money allows to like incorporate other garments into the system. And then the second aspect, which is what I'm sort of calling replay right now, take any feedback here, but like this replay, so that's like the fun, that's the replay is the more fun, experimental, not quite sure like what people are most interested in doing or paying for or spending time on or learning about. So it encompasses everything from like sharing projects online of how to remake things yourself or how to host a swap, to actually providing some of those services on a limited local scale, to partnering with other brands on collaborations to help them remake some of their dead stock. That's really a testing ground and can grow and scale, like I was saying, with other people, with other businesses. I see that as more of like a joint collaborative effort, whereas Vicenzi will always be, like I started it with the idea of like, this needs to last longer than I will. And like, my last name might not even be Vicenzi in the future, but like the brand will stay as just like an homage to my family, and maybe my kids one day want to work there, who knows. But like, I love this idea of starting a family business now, first generation. Because you hear so much about like, this is a fourth generation brand, and I admire that passing down of craftsmanship so much, but I didn't have that in my life. So I like this idea of creating a brand that will last a long time, but then to keep things sort of current and relevant too, and like to satisfy my other needs of like, I don't know, being a little bit more playful and like fun, that's where this replay. So these two are gonna somehow be connected but separate.
They're gonna sustain each other.
They sustain each other, and they hopefully provide enough solutions and interest and ideas to people that they can get excited about fashion or more actively involved in fashion in a new way that's not currently available to them, I think, and like kind of open up some connection points. But again, you have to meet people where they're at, and I don't know like what are people interested in most, so always seeking feedback or ideas directly from customers about what would help them solve problems, because I have a ton of ideas about it. But I think, in closing, maybe like for the industry, I challenge everyone in the industry to test your ideas with the consumers, because I think we have a lot of great solutions in mind, but if the consumers don't understand them or don't want them, it doesn't matter. It's just an idea and a concept, and I don't want to get stuck in those phases. I think for years I had to be in that phase because I was learning a lot, but now I'm excited to share more, test more, help people, like even garment by garment remake something, because that helps you rethink the rest of your wardrobe, and that'd be a good like first place to start.
Final question, and I ask this to everybody on the show, so it's the one consistent thread. How do you think you've grown as an entrepreneur? In what ways?
I've learned to be a lot more realistic. I had sort of like big ideas, and then I had small little things I would focus on, and now I'm trying to like net out in the middle, where you can still dream big and have big ideas, but what is the most realistic path forward? That's one answer. That's sort of like maybe a normal answer to give. But I've also just had to, I mean, that's been the biggest challenge of my own self and like where I fit in this world and questioning so much about everything. A lot of introspection, a lot of like realization that you as an individual hold a lot of power within yourself, and I think as a society we look to the outside world for solutions a lot. We look for another book to read or another feel-good thing or another conversation to have, but at the end of the day, like it's actually, or any time in the day, you just turn inward and realize you probably already have what you need to do it, to do anything. So it's helped me narrow down, I would say, distractions or things that I thought I needed or were necessary to be successful, or to, I mean, I don't even, I have different ways of defining success, but like to feel balanced and whole, I need a lot less than I thought or society told me I needed. So I think other people might find the same. But you have to start somewhere.
You have to start somewhere. And Allison is definitely well along on her entrepreneurial journey with Vicenzi.co. You go to the Instagram, you get your blazers, and you become part of the sustainable fashion business model.